plug in the recorder?
Yes.
I've got to get a little adapter, yes, it takes one for that thing and one for that.
I think the thing to do would be to run it all off this one here. Let's get a double amp adapter for there. There's one right here, plug right here.
Hey! How's that frost you? You pinned something up. Hello, test, hello, 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 hello.
Would be confined to only those that the council has responsibility for.
Yeah, let me search for it. In Title 24 of the state code deals with the legislature itself, and this refers to the appropriations, in this case it also refers to audits, but the transfers that they're talking about there are only those funds that are set out in the budget or elsewhere for carrying out sections 10 through 140. Chapter 2405. Which are the general powers and composition of the legislature. But this, that raises a question here. Maybe somebody else wants to look at these statutes, but there's quite a number of other things for which we might make appropriations in here besides sections 10 through 140. Section 2405-160 deals with the sessions, 190 deals with space, 200 deals with administrative services, 210 is expenses in the budget, and it goes on. The officers are chapter 10 24 10, and the compensation, the agencies of the legislature. In other words, the council
appropriation transfers, those transfers will come only from sections 10 through 140?
That's right.
Okay. And from none other?
From none other, the way the bill is written, but why doesn't somebody take a look at these statutes here? I can see what you think about them. I think that this...
I'm less concerned about is what happens with those contract gaps if they can just reshuffle the funds each time within sections 10 through 40, when you have excess funds that you have not expended, do they lapse like every other?
They would lapse. Unless, you know, unless the council reallocates those monies for something else that they want to do within the fiscal year, they're bound by the same restrictions on the appropriations everyone else is. It couldn't be expended outside of the fiscal year.
What's your question, Mr. Chairman?
Okay, my question is there that does, we're talking about section about 2405, sections 10 through 140. But in addition to sections 10 through 140 under 2405, there's a number of other things that the Legislative Council does through the Legislative Affairs Agency. And we make appropriations for those things. And why is a law as written now just talk about sections 10 through 140? I would think that maybe I'm getting something wrong here. Okay, that's the agencies. Okay, this is where it's looking wrong.
Oh,
chapter.
There you go. Why?
Yeah, okay. No, that right. Is all of it, sure. Okay. Trying to answer your question, Phil, we'd just be talking about the money that's appropriated each year for the operation of the legislature. The council could make transfers in the amounts of, between the amounts of money appropriated to the legislature on the approval, well, the council can do it. But that doesn't affect any other agency of state government or any other portion of the state budget.
Well, this is a house bill, house, you know, a housekeeping.
Yeah, housekeeping type of bill.
There's no change anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
And what Thal was talking about is apparently you were chairman of a subcommittee on. Appropriation. So you didn't use all that money. But your concern is, will that money lapse into the general fund, or will it remain? You know, or will it remain within the legislative
council
budget? And then whatever you save, someone else will gobble up. I think that's what your concern is. Well, of course, you can control that by line item budget. You know. Restricted to that one purpose, and you, whatever your subcommittee was, apparently you had a consultant or a contractor, somebody to make a study for you. Well, the balance, what you're trying to say is you don't want them to spend it for something else, as long as you say that you want it to go to the general fund.
The only way that I can see to get around that is, well, you can.
You can line item budget it. You know, you've still got to send the bill to the Senate, then you've got to have, I understand, you know, the chairman of the council might dream up all kinds of things besides what they originally started with. They'd like to have some slop in the kitty and in the playroom.
There's some reasons, though, on the other hand, there's some good reasons for maybe changing, for allowing transfers. For instance, if appropriation is made extending throughout the fiscal year, like beginning for FY77, beginning July 1, 1976, and running to the end of June of 1977, well, a new legislature may be sitting. So a new legislature, I would think, might have according to the goals and purposes of the members of the legislature, might be entirely different from the last one. And I would think that you wouldn't want to tie their hands. They're elected by the people, that they should, you know, be responsive and should have the ability to change things. That's one thing that you might want to take into account, is during the fiscal year, the makeup of the council could change entirely. So it would leave them flexibility. Okay, we have a motion to report out the committee substitute. Is there further discussion on the motion? Okay, Ernie, you were on the phone there. What we did is that last sentence of section two would now read, I think you got that little proposed amendment. We took all of it except the last words at the direction of the council. That was considered by the committee to be redundant and taken out, so it would read now the last sentence. All expenditures of the council are subject to an independent audit which shall be made annually, period. Making the language from the original bill, making it mandatory instead of permissive as it was originally written. That requires the audit annually. The way it is presently, of course, they can do the audit if they feel like, and they can do it on an annual basis or not. But it doesn't specifically call for it. So that's the only.
Is it automatically understood that this will be available to the legislature?
Yes, well, I think it is. We could add language to that effect, but if someone thinks that should be done, this would be an appropriate time to do it.
I don't know. You can beat a bad horse to death, but their record's no better than anybody else's. I don't care. The way you've got it is pretty much for you. Get enough reports in the mail.
Okay, further discussion on the motion? There's no further discussion or call for the question. Those in favor of reporting out the committee substitute for House Bill number 550, signify by raising your right hand. Those opposed? Motion carried unanimously. How many do passes on the bill? Okay, majority do pass recommendation. I don't have any further business to bring before the committee, real business, except to say that we're going to shoot for a meeting at 4:30 p.m. this afternoon. Attendance is not compulsory, but we're going to discuss the implications of the Pooch case on education and get an idea of what that is going to do. As far as our appropriate, get some idea, help us get an idea of what that'll do as far as the appropriations process goes for school construction operation. And we'll have that meeting here this afternoon, tentatively scheduled at 4:30 p.m. If you can't make it, you'll probably miss something, but we're not going to take any action. It's just an informative meeting. No. What we're going to do is examine the ramifications of the case itself. Later on in the examination of the budget, we'll get into that with the administration and the Department of Public Works, the Department of Education. This is just to get an idea of the legal principles involved, what that means. As possible.
Who's going to be doing it then?
I don't know the names of the people that are going to be here. Really, it's perhaps we'll have someone from the Attorney General's office at that time. Some of the people are working on the on the other side of the case, and Mr. Coxon said he could be in attendance also. There's no, I've got no further business to bring before the committee right now. We will have a meeting, just in advance notice, we'll have a meeting at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning as well.
What is that?
Well, we've got a budget, the governor's budget message today, don't we?
Oh, that's good.
So that'll take up most of the... Without objection, meeting's adjourned. Some recommendations, we got the staffing situation resolved for the seven members of the committee who are not chairman. We've got a total of 5 slots that are available for the committee to fill, and I suppose some of those people have already been hired. Do you have anything, Earl? Okay. I'd like to check to make sure that the people get on the payroll properly, and John? Okay, we'll more or less call this meeting to order now that Representative Green's here. And you see, it's not a formal meeting, and the committee's not going to make any decisions here today. Just an idea. The idea is to get, if we can, some inkling of the legal principles involved in the so-called Hooch case, and to get some idea, perhaps, of how that affects the state appropriations. Later on in the consideration of the state budget and the bonding proposals for rural schools, we'll have the state administration respond as to how they're trying to meet these goals. It's just an informative meeting that's going to be conducted on an informal basis. We are recording the meeting for future reference, although, unless there's some good reason, we're not going to prepare a written transcript of this meeting. And Foxon is here, with some people from Alaska Legal Services. And maybe you could give us a general idea on how the basis of the case, how you think the thing might affect the future of education in Alaska.
Okay, for the record, my name is Don Clarkson. I'm the legislative person for Alaska Legal Services. As most of you know, I'll be here during the session. I want to just introduce the two people who are here with me and give just a couple of short comments, and I'll let them talk about the lawsuit and what it has to do with the governor's budget message and budget that he's been given. First of all, is Steve Cotton over here, is from Cambridge, Massachusetts. He is the counsel lawyer that we attached to this case along with Alaska Legal Services some 2 or 3 years ago when the Hooch case became active. Bruce Twomley here is a staff attorney in the Anchorage office of Alaska Legal Services. These are the two fellows that have been working principally on the Hooch case. One introductory comment I might make, two comments. First of all, we do not have an organized presentation. You need to say this has been somewhat... We didn't have much notice. But we do have this map here, which I think they can explain. Secondly, these two fellows have been negotiating for the last 4 or 5 months in detail and aggressively with the state attempting to settle this case. They were negotiating under a commitment of confidentiality with regard to the subject of their negotiations. It is my opinion, they may not be prepared to say it, but it is my opinion that confidentiality is all off now because of the decision by the administration to cut the amount of money which is necessary to build the schools that they're going to be talking about. They're not at all happy with that decision. That's what they're going to be talking to me about. All I'm saying is that there may be some difficult decisions with their discussions with regard to the negotiations. They may hesitate to answer specific questions, but I think we can go far enough to satisfy them if necessary. This has been going on for 3 or 4 years, and I think they can bring you up to date on where we stand today.
Okay, along that line, later on, when we get into consideration of the governor's budget, his proposals, at that point, will there be any problem, do you suppose, with continuing negotiations?
Well, they, and I'm sure they'll be able to tell you this, they have not made the determination of whether they're going to continue negotiations at all. Obviously, we are extremely disappointed at the change in position by the governor's office. If negotiations continue, there will continue to be some problems with ethical discussion of those negotiations. If negotiations terminate, that'll be a different story.
So one question on this, Don, when, you know, where you're discussing a negotiation, something that's so obviously a matter of public policy, why does any rule of confidentiality apply?
As I understand it, that was sort of an agreement made by the parties in this specific instance. Yes. And again, I emphasize, I don't consider it particularly binding at this point. It is obviously a public issue. It is now in front of the legislature. Mm-hmm. The governor has done that. So I think it's much more open. With that, these two fellas have been working on this case for years, and I think that they're the best ones to bring up to date on where we are, where we're different than the administration proposal. And
along those lines, you might, I think people are generally familiar with each case, but you might start by telling us what it is, why it was initiated, and what's come out of it so far, at least insofar as you're able to respect any you know, agreements that you feel obligated to uphold.
I'm going to follow suit by removing my coat as well.
No cigarettes.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for the invitation to come in here and informally impart some information about this item that was in both the governor's state address and in his budget message today. For the record, I am Stephen Cotton, and I am an attorney at the Harvard Center for Law and Education, part of the Legal Services Program, and the National Backup Center for Education Cases. Our role is to help legal services programs any place in the country that have difficult education cases and request us to come in and help. And I can think of no more difficult education case than the Hooch case. I've been working on this litigation for approximately 2 years with Bruce Plumley, the staff attorney at the Anchorage Office of Alaska Legal Services, and have been working on this case. Briefly, the litigation itself was filed in 1972 on behalf of children throughout the state, Native children, who reside in villages where there are elementary schools but are not, but where there is not a local high school through the 12th grade. These are the children who have to go away to school, participate in a boarding program someplace in the state if they want to pursue a high school education. Now, as all of you are aware, a portion of this case was decided by the state Supreme Court in May of last year. That portion of the case dealt with the state Supreme Court's reading of the state constitutional provision mandating free public education. The state Supreme Court interpreted that provision in a way that was contrary to what we had urged them. I mean, a 4-1 decision said that there was no right, as an educational right, under the state constitution to have a high school in one's community of residence. That disposed of a portion of the case, but by far not the most complex portion of the case. What the rest of the case consists of is allegations by the plaintiffs that the current system of failing to provide local high schools for children in the villages where they live is based, at least in part, on improper and impermissible racial considerations in violation of the state constitution and the United States Constitution. That is the portion of the case which the state Supreme Court said in part was remanded to the lower court, in part had not been before the state Supreme Court, and which we are preparing. The next step in that would be to go to trial on that issue. As Don said, there have been settlement negotiations, and until today we have taken the pledge of confidentiality even to embrace talking about the very fact that there were settlement negotiations going on. The governor today indicated, his words were that there was something, I think he said, $20 million being made available as a partial settlement of the case. And I take it that that indicates public statement by the governor to the effect that there have been at least discussions about possible settlements of the case. I don't feel free, however, as a matter of legal ethics, to talk at all about the substance of those negotiations. I wish I could. But what I can talk about is the nature of the case, the nature of possible legislative solutions to the case. The state Supreme Court, in deciding the first round of the Hooch litigation, ended its decision like this, and I think the words are worth noting. We believe that resolution of the complex problems pertaining to the location and quality of secondary education are best determined by the legislative process. That was one sentence. I, as a lawyer, would concur in that. If it were possible to determine this, the outcome of this, by the legislative process, I think we would all be better off. But the court went on to say as follows: we shall not, however, hesitate to intervene if a violation of the constitutional rights to equal treatment under either the Alaska or United States constitutions is established. And that, indeed, is the rest of the litigation. If there is no other solution, then it will be up to the courts to determine if, as the plaintiffs allege, there have been violations of the rights to equal treatment. In terms of what a legislative solution would entail to them, part of the solution has already been taken care of by the legislature in its reorganization of rural education authorities. That is the dissolution of SOS and the creation of the regional education boards has meant that there now is provided automatically through the foundation program the operational funds to have secondary schools in any village in which a regional education board decides to operate one. The barrier to doing that in the villages here is one of capital construction. That was the part of this problem that the governor addressed, but only in a partial way in his budget message today. What we're talking about here, basically, the nub of this, is 108 villages throughout the unorganized borough. There are 108 dots on those maps, one in that map, one for each of the villages that's involved here. Each of those villages have an elementary school, one that's operated either by the state or by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. None of those villages at present has a secondary school, a secondary program that goes through the 12th grade. In each of those villages, the kids who finish the 8th grade, if they want to go on to high school, have to board out someplace else. Those villages vary widely in size. They are as small as villages where there are one-room school in which the secondary population is maybe a half dozen kids. They are as large as villages that have upwards of 25, 30, up to 50 or more kids of secondary school age. That means, of course, the construction costs for any of those schools would vary from virtually nothing. That is, if the kids stayed home and were supervised by the existing one or two teachers in the village, it would entail virtually no construction costs to accommodate them, or construction costs that are at most very minimal. On the other end of the ledger are villages where a high school of some size would have to be built at a cost of anywhere from $750,000 to $1.5 million. Now, Don referred to a reversal in the governor's position, and what he was alluding to was not anything that we are divulging about the content of the negotiations, because, as I said, I at least don't feel at liberty to do that. But there have been public statements on behalf of the governor made at various times, one occasion in particular, at which it was declared that the governor was committed to a bond package in current proposal to handle the problem of the 108 villages in the amount of $50 million. That was the statement that was made in mid-December. As you know, today's message indicated that that entire amount was not going to be asked for in the budget request, but rather $20 million would be asked for. The governor himself referred to this as a partial settlement. And whether it's settlement or no, it certainly is a partial amount. At least there is the public recognition by the governor that $20 million just doesn't do the job. As to the $50 million, there's nothing inconsistent with what we've been dealing with in the substance of this case that we've come across that would indicate that that is an unreasonable amount to think of in terms of trying to deal with this problem. And I think in terms of a legislative solution, that imparts, at least in outline, the information. That is, the $50 million has been declared on behalf of the governor to be an amount that would deal with this problem. $20 million is what has been forthcoming in the budget request.
Well, as far as the statement by the court that they wouldn't hesitate to intervene if there was unequal treatment under the law, what's the status of that? Is that being alleged? People are being treated unequally, or that the rights are being infringed upon?
Yes, it is. I don't think it is that this is the proper forum, particularly where the Attorney General's office is not here, but in any event, that this is the proper forum to argue the case. The proper forum is the court.
Mm-hmm.
But the allegation, yes, is that the failure to provide secondary schools at home for these children is arbitrary, and more than that, it is racially discriminatory.
Steve?
Yeah,
Mr.
Chairman. Mr. Cutton, what is Legal Services' position in this case? Is it Legal Services' position that a high school should be constructed in any village where there is some X number of students? What is your position in this case? What do you think we ought to do?
Any village that is sufficiently large and sufficiently stable that the state or the BIA has gone in already and put in a school of whatever size, so that there currently is a day school operator, there currently is a teacher or a staff of teachers in there teaching kids through the eighth grade, that program should be expanded to enable kids who want to stay there through the 12th grade. Now, when you say construction, as I've indicated, in some places that means construction. There's no other way to do it. There's no other facility. In a good many of those cases, that doesn't mean instruction. It simply means supervision. Indeed, perhaps by the very teacher who's there.
Okay, let me ask you something now. Excuse me. Well, Bill, did you have a comment?
If you want, I had a comment on that. If you want to immediately.
I was really kind of following up here. And I can direct the question to any of you guys who want to answer it, but I'd like to have an answer. What do you think is an adequate high school education? Do you think it's an adequate high school education to have, if we were to do this, to have a school there with one teacher, where you have, for instance, 10 kids who are high school age? Do you think it's adequate to have one teacher there? Or do you think we ought to have, for instance, a full battery of specialized teachers and a chemistry lab and this sort of thing in each village?
There are a couple of responses to that. You've got to look at it in a practical way as to what's feasible and what would be involved in actually providing high school instruction. I don't think there's any doubt, I don't think there's any dissent on the part of the State Board of Education, Department of Education, at the desirability of having small high schools in virtually all of these villages, if that's what the people there want. Now, in terms of what kind of education would be delivered, right now, there are very small high schools around the state. If you take a look at Thorne Bay, a close neighbor to down here, logging camp, there are 24 kids approximately in a high school there that in fact does have a little chemistry lab and does have a full-size gymnasium and a lot of other facilities. And that's for 24 kids, and that's a state-operated school. I'm not sure you have to do that in every village, but that is being done in some.
Interrupted by the
outage last night.
When we were so rudely interrupted, Mr. Cooper had the floor and he was asking some questions he had in mind. Steve, would you like to continue?
Yeah. Mr. Cotton, I believe I had addressed some questions to you directly, but anybody else who wants to answer may. The question was, of course, directed to the fact that there is a policy decision to be made as to, from an educational standpoint, as to whether it's better for a child in grades 9 through 12 particularly to attend school in his village, his or her village, where the educational, where of necessity it may be that you can only give them a fairly rudimentary education in a traditional sense, or whether it's better to give him the exposure at least to the sort of more varied curricula and other programs that would be available in a large regional high school. I take it that you realize that it would be practically impossible to build a large high school with, say, 20 or 25 teachers of varying specialties and the type of supporting equipment and so on in every village. You understand that's simply not, you just can't do that.
Nor does anyone on behalf of the plaintiffs or people out in the villages that I've talked to ask for that, expect that.
Okay. Well, anyway, you recognize that that is a substantial problem without your having to comment on the policy itself. That is a substantial policy that has to be decided somewhere, whether it's better to have those regional schools in every village or whether it's better to have what I would take to be a heck of a lot better educational opportunity in a regional high school.
If I can address myself to several aspects of the problem that you're raising, it's not an inconsiderable one. It's not one that people who have thought about the legal aspects of the case have ignored, nor is it one that parents in the villages have ignored. It's a question, in fact, that in my experience going to villages in connection with this case, going to about 30 villages across the state, is one that I have put to the parents time after time. When I've gone into a village and there have been meetings over a period of a day, 2 days, in which people have come and told me what they wanted, and what they wanted as a lawyer purporting to represent the class, what they wanted me to try to get for them. One of the questions, and I've taken it to be a hard question that I put to them, is precisely the one that you've said. Don't you realize you're not going to have 25 teachers in this village? Don't you realize it's going to be a smaller school? It's not going to have all of the electives. It's not going to have all of the shops that you can get in the Anchorage school, or that you can get even in the Bethel school, or that you could get even if there were an area school embracing perhaps 10 villages. Don't you realize that? And what do you want to do about that? And with almost startling unanimity, the answer is we've gone around the room in village after village that the parents have said is, yes, we understand that. Yes, we understand that the academic quality of the program won't be as varied if we have a smaller school. But that doesn't matter. That's not what's important to us, because there are first, other values that are more important.
Okay, okay. Let me interrupt you there for a second. By what you just said, you have to realize that that's a political decision.
Isn't it a parental decision in part?
I don't know whether it is or not, but regardless of whether it's a parental decision or not, I don't know whether it is necessarily a parental decision at that age. It may be more relevant to talk to the students when they're in the 9th through 12th grade. But in any event, when you're talking about going around and asking people what they'd prefer to do, you're talking about a political decision.
Well, I don't know whether you characterize it as political or otherwise, but the answer that I get back from the people who were affected by this is don't have people in Juneau telling us that we can't have a family life if our kids are to try to get some sort of high school education. Well, don't have the social engineering where the only way our kids can get daily instruction in high school is to have them moved out of the family. There are other things, educational things, that they can learn by being in the village. They can learn values that we can teach them. They can learn skills that they're going to need if they're going to live in the village.
The point of the inquiry is not whether or not to determine at this hearing what's best for the children, but to ask you, I'll ask you, whether you think it's an appropriate forum in the courts to decide that policy question. Whether the courts are in a position to say it's better for children to receive an education in their own village than it is for them to go to a regional high school where better curricula are presented. I don't say that it is. I don't know as we're talking about that in this particular hearing, but how is the court going to provide a remedy? You know, anytime you have an issue before the courts and you expect to prevail, you better have not only a right but a remedy. How is the court going to provide a remedy in this case?
By permitting parents in the villages where there now are elementary schools but not high schools the opportunity to exercise a right, an entitlement to a local secondary program. If they don't want it, if they choose the way you're suggesting that some might, a way, incidentally, that I've never heard in the villages, they don't have, there's not going to be forced on them. But it is a permission to exercise an entitlement. And I might add that in no other segment of Alaskan society, in no other segment of American society, is one of the assumptions that underlies some of your questions taken for granted, the notion that you would take kids out of their family with no other choice in order to go through the 12th grade. No other segment except the Alaskan natives here are told that the only way you could get daily instruction at the high school level is to have no family life for 3/4 of the year.
Yeah, but you're misconstruing my question. The question is, what has the court got to do with any of that? Who is the court going to order to do what? Is the court going to order the legislature to send the money out?
Well, I don't...
I think this is a serious matter of separation of powers, frankly. I might state that I was the prevailing counsel in Breach versus Smith, that you're relying on in large part, so I'm not out of sympathy with your aim. But how do you propose to affect any sort of settlement that you work out with the Attorney General's office? How are you going to enforce it?
I don't think this is the proper forum to get into what might be at some time put before the court. I just don't think it's appropriate here at this stage in pending litigation, nor to argue the legal merits of various plans for relief. But I think when the court said in the Hooch decision on the first claim of this, that if a violation of equal protection is established, it will not hesitate to intervene, I think the court meant what it said. And if the form that might take and how a plan for relief might be structured, whether it might be structured in the manner that Justice Rabinowitz said in his dissent, that is, an order for a plan for construction over some period of time, how that might be structured and what the precise content is, I think would be something that would be developed in the course of litigation. And I don't think it would be proper for me to spell out what we might offer to the court at some time or to anticipate precisely what the court might do. But I think when the court said that if there is a violation of equal protection, we won't hesitate to intervene, they meant what they said, and it wasn't an empty notion with no content.
Well, I don't want to dominate the question here. I don't want to show myself off right now. But, my observation is that this is an area where the court, now, of course, if there's a violation of the Equal Protection Clause, which I don't think it is, then that's one thing. I don't think it's an area where the court has any jurisdiction, and I think for the court to stray into this sort of policy-making area I think that was recognized in Justice Bouchida's original opinion. It's not an area where the court ought to be, and I question whether any settlement that the Legal Services Corporation makes on behalf of these plaintiffs with the Attorney General's office, whether that will have any effect whatsoever. The policy decisions that are going to take place in this body, and I'll just leave it there.
Let me suggest to you, because I would like to respond to a couple of the things that you have brought up, because I think they're legitimate concerns, and I'd like to be as responsive as I can to them. And if I may, I'd just like to address myself to some of them. One of them is, I think it is all around preferable. I think it is preferable from the point of view of the plaintiffs. I think it is preferable from the point of view of educational policy in general. I think it is preferable from the point of view of the state that this not be resolved, as the majority opinion who said, by means of a court decree. If it were possible for the legislature to arrive at a policy decision in this area and make the money available, follow through on a policy to provide local high schools, set out the parameters of that, I would think that is vastly preferable to having this resolved in the adversary process of the judiciary. I think if it can be done that way, that's the course to go. I think everybody benefits from it. If it can't be done that way, then as a lawyer representing clients who I sincerely believe have a legitimate constitutional claim, we have no choice but to pursue the litigation. But I think all around we all do better if this is resolved through the legislative process. And in part, that's the reason that I've responded to the invitation and the opportunity to be here. I
think that's a better way to go, I really do. Secondly, some of the questions that you have about the viability of education in a small secondary school, I think are questions that the Department of Education has, through experience, addressed itself to, and can, within some limits, deliver on a potential to provide a reasonably good secondary education to even small groups of people. Educational skill, technology, and experience in small bush schools has proved that it can be success in a small program. Department of Education experience, Department of Education publications bear that out. We have experience in small communities across the state with very small high schools. Thorne Bay down here in Alaska, in Southeast, 24 kids, has a pretty good program. There are other places that off and on have had very small programs. Gustavus has had a high school program with a part-time certificated teacher for a half dozen kids from time to time. It is possible, it is something we have experience with, and given correspondence, given media packages, given opportunities for cross-fertilization, given the fact that there are elementary teachers in these places who could come over to a high school setting and teach a course in their major or minor subject, more variety and ability to deliver an educational program is available than it first appears.
All right, well, the point was that they're political questions to me.
That's thank you. I think that's me touching on what Steve was getting at, but yesterday you mentioned two sums, 20 million and 50 million, 20 being too low and 50 being a figure that was justified in light of what you're trying to reach. But you know, why is 20 too low, or why isn't 50 too low? Why not 100? You know, how do you pick the figure? In other words, you mentioned also a mechanism. What do you see as the best mechanism as far as the plaintiffs are concerned, or other people that are not actually party or suit? How are they best represented in picking a figure? And once the figure is picked, how do you determine, who determines how that money and where it should be spent? I mean, you're not saying that in any settlement you reach that would be something between you and the government. I mean, you have other mechanisms in mind as far as reaching a sum that we, in the end, as legislators, would have to determine, and mechanisms that would be involved in spreading that money or distributing that money.
The source of the $50 million figure, I want to be absolutely clear, is not a source that is arrived at or agreed upon in the course of negotiation. As I've said, what the figures that have been traded back and forth in that kind of context is material that perhaps the Attorney General's office would supply, but it would be inappropriate for me to come in here and break what I regard as a confidence. The $50 million figure, however, was one that was advanced publicly by a representative of the governor. And on that basis, if that's the figure that they are advancing publicly, I'm not going to dispute that figure. The source of that figure, however, is the executive branch, not the plaintiffs in this case. Now, as to the adequacy or inadequacy of that figure, what content do I see in that figure? I go down the list of 108 villages, try to break them into some categories informed by the knowledge that I've gained in how budgeting has been done by state-operated schools, the legislature, and the Department of Education in the past, and try to assess what reasonable facilities would cost in each of those 108 villages. Those are rough planning figures, but the same kind of rough planning figures that are regularly used when bills are submitted by the governor for bond issues. That is, there are formulas that are used, ballpark figures that are used that have been proved by experience to be reasonably accurate, even though at times there are shortfalls with the difference of the project. But using the same kind of process, that is, square footage per child, number of dollars per square foot average construction cost, scaling that down for very small locations.
Well, you haven't actually got into that. That hasn't been part of your function yet.
I have indeed looked at that in the course of this. We have not gone into this without having some idea, even a very close idea, of what the cost would be in terms of construction. And so having made that close an analysis of what is in fact involved, and admittedly not one that is hard and fast down to the penny, but pretty close site by site, taking into account projected enrollments based on current enrollments and trends in the school. We know site by site what's a reasonable projected secondary enrollment based on the current school populations in each of these villages. We know the planning formulas that are used and have been used to project building costs for them. We have thought through what would be appropriate staffing patterns to take account of whether one classroom or no classroom might be built. And putting that all together, one can come up with reasonable dollar figures on what the capital needs would be. There might be some exceptions to in the sense that in a particular location it might be more expensive than in another location. In the event, it might turn out to be less expensive, or a public facility in the village might be utilized as a classroom and nothing might be needed. I mean, there certainly is room for variation, but when you get to what's a reasonable dollar projection, I think we have the information as close at hand as it usually is when the Department of Education goes to the legislature and asks for a bond package, and when the legislature acts on that. So that these are not figures pulled out of the air. This looks like it'd be a reasonable compromise, or this looks like it would be a reasonable price tag to put on the right to a local education. It's not that kind of question. The question has been, what would it take to provide a reasonable level of capital construction facilities to handle the need of each of 108 villages, given known enrollment?
Well, you wouldn't see your settlement, your work is cutting off any rights of the other villages, or the same villages for that matter, for asking more for a different kind of solution. In other words, I hope what you're trying to do is get a recognition of the right for secondary education in villages rather than amount. Looking at like the land claims, it would be like a court coming along and saying that Congress only had a right to appropriate so much money for the land claim solution, which ultimately came from Congress. But I'm concerned about that whoever you represent, whatever communication you have with those people that are in the villages, that any settlement not purport to settle any rights that they may have for any solution they may work out themselves through either the regional attendance areas or through any other entity.
Absolutely. I mean, I think anything that we are trying to do here is not sort of saying, let's get $1 million for Village X, that does it, period, sign here and it's all over. No, what we are trying to do in the course of this litigation, and indeed in trying to impart as much information as we can to the representatives most vitally concerned with this, is to get enough money made available, distributed among the villages in the sense of allocated by project amounts, but to permit villages an opportunity they have not had heretofore, to have a local high school that they so wish. If they want to see consolidation in some way or not have a local high school, they're not entitled to a dollar amount to be spent in that village regardless of their choice. The money would be available, though, to permit what most of those villages are going to want, which is a local high school program, but where they don't want that and want to get together or have the regional board have an area high school serving more than one village, all of that would be permissible within the framework of what we're trying to do. In the sense of defining what the right is, the right we are trying to define is one that's not a dollar amount. The amount of educational entitlement of this village is $1 million. So no, that's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to say a high school in that village. And then at the same time, because we're not looking for open-ended commitments to build lavish facilities, we're trying to look reasonably at what that would entail. To see, is, as has been suggested, when those figures have not been available, this such an excessively costly thing is to be totally unreasonable. And in fact, when you look down soberly at the problem and try to cost it out, you don't come up with a figure much different from the one that the governor's office was relying on as of last month. That is, when you define the right to a local program, and then you don't ignore the price tag on that. And when you look at the price tag on that, it's not too different from the one, at least to my way of thinking, than the one that the governor was relying on.
Let me say that the only function of the dollar figure is to give us a program to create a choice that won't be present in the absence of that money. It's not the function of the suit, the function of RBD and practice information, isn't to dictate any solution at a local level. It's just to create an option. One doesn't exist presently for our funding.
Yes, I would just like to say a few words in question to maybe the sheriff. Various members we have here. I've been following this case pretty closely since it was first filed, and I used to serve on the Johnson O'Malley Review Committee, which time Chris Cook, we are members, it was a statewide group of many people interested in attaining high school facilities in all the villages, it was statewide, and every region was represented there. And we went over this case pretty closely, and the information that we received seemed to be pretty favorable based on my travels to the villages and to the others who were members of that review board. And we've endorsed it time and time again and encouraged that something favorable come out of it. And one other point that I'd like to bring out is that it's quite uncomfortable at times to have to go as far as the court system to settle a matter that should have been settled by the state some time ago. I recall in my own experiences in my area, before we got the North Slope Borough, our schools were operated by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And many times we determined that the attitude of BIA was a lot better than the state of Alaska at the time. And because of that problem, we fought very hard for the creation of the North Slope Borough and for that to realize. And our primary concern at the time was for us to be able to maintain the family unit at home, because as part of our way of life, the family units are very, very close, a lot closer than what I have seen during my travels to the Rural 48 and to the city. There's a closeness that it's hard to define in words, but when you're there, you can understand why the families want their teenagers to be there in the village. And this case is widely supported, as far as I know, in the villages that I represent and in the villages that I went to in 1968, where I covered around 370 villages, starting from Barrow, Nome, Constable, and Bethel area. And the thing that I heard time and time again, it sounds like a broken record, is that we really need high school facilities in our village. And I have never heard any testimony from any school board, village council, any kind of board, that we do not want high schools in their villages. Everyone, I have never heard any testimony contrary to that. Thank you.
Thank you. Because it answers some of the questions that I have. But you know, it seems to me that if we decide based on this court decree where to put the schools, that we're forcing those choices on the local school boards that really ought to have the decisions. I mean, in other words, I mean, I would rather have the regional school board, for instance, on the Delta or somewhere, come in and say, hey, look, you know, we'd rather, what we want is a school in a Monarch and another one in St. Michael and another one so-and-so and so-and-so. I'd rather get it from there than have a court decree tell us where we ought to put the schools.
Yeah, I can really appreciate that concern, because there have been cases, I think, not in the education field, but in other fields, where somebody else has decided for the villages without knowing them. I can really appreciate that concern. And as to my understanding, the 107 or 108 villages that you're talking about, maybe you could, how did you, have you told the committee members how you formed those 108 villages? How did they come into this?
108 villages.
And also, how do the regional, the new attendance areas deal with? Are there any conflicts?
We can see no possible conflict between this case and the smooth operation of the regional attendance area. Regional attendance areas will be the people who will in fact implement the programs in as many villages as possible. Anything that we're looking for in the way of coming to the aid of these villages is not a decree that would impose on the villages, nor legislative action, if that were the proper end of this, that would impose on villages or regional boards that didn't want them a solution, again, thought up in Anchorage or Juneau, but rather an opportunity meaningfully to exercise a right to get these schools, make enough money available so that villages that want them can have the schools. Now, the 108 villages are all of the villages in the unorganized borough in which there are, these are the native villages, in an organized borough where there are currently operating elementary schools, but where kids can't stay in the village through the 12th grade. That's where the figure 108 comes from. And our notion throughout this thing would be not to say to a village, okay, the construction crew is on the way, you're going to have a high school with compulsory attendance, you're all going to go to that high school, and that's the new system, goodbye. But rather to afford those villages the opportunity to avail themselves of this.
Yeah, Mr.
Chairman?
Mr. Naughton.
Are any of the federal assistance in education programs, Title I, Title III, Title IV, such as those, written in such a way that Alaska might be in jeopardy of having to return money to the federal government in case the village school situation isn't corrected?
Well, all of those programs, of course, come under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which says that no money, federal money, can be given to any program in which there is discrimination. Of course, if the court were to determine, as the plaintiffs allege here, that there has been discrimination in the operation of the system, of course, those monies would run afoul of the language of Title VI. The short answer to your question is that, that there is a statute on the book which at least suggests there might be some problem.
What range of dollars are we talking about there? Is it in the neighborhood of 50, 100 million?
I just don't know offhand and have at my fingertips the precise Title I contribution to the state. It is that Title I is the largest federal program that the eight state operated schools in Alaska, and I don't know at this point exactly what that is, what the dimensions are. And certainly, the federal aid to education in the state is substantial.
Yes, just one more thing that I'd like to add here. They had a meeting with the Native Caucus, the Bush Caucus, yesterday. And after listening to them, we felt that there is no conflict on what they're saying to the priorities and from what we have seen in the villages. And I think that if there was any kind of conflict, that we would be mindful to correct it.
Comments or questions for the other members of the committee?
If I should the $20 million bond prevail, how are you going to be able to select which villages should be taken care of first with that project?
That's up to the state and the legislature. I don't know how you go about saying to some villages we'll give you the high schools and not the others. That's something we'd have a lot of difficulty doing, but that would be a legislative determination based, I presume, at least in part, on the recommendations of the governor. I don't know how they would go about selecting themselves. That is, if there are any number of ways, I presume one could. I think one possible way is to simply go down the list of villages affected and pick off those with the largest projected enrollment. If you did that, you went down the list to pick out $20 million worth of projects in the top villages in terms of enrollment, you cover 19 or 20 sites. That would leave approximately 90 other locations with nothing.
I guess the governor's message was a disappointment yesterday. Was that, the end of the negotiations? Or is that,
I don't know.
What are the negotiations going to attempt to make? Or the governor said that's it? I got the impression that you were expecting a decision yesterday on his part as to accept some offer or something. That you were unsure as to what his budget position was going to be and what his comments were.
Well, in fact, the governor's budget decision to the tune of $20 million had been reported the week before in the Anchorage Times. It had become public information long before he, in fact, made his so that in that sense it was no surprise to anyone following closely by having read that article in the Anchorage Times a week ago Monday.
But you had other indications prior that the figure would be larger.
Again, what I can say about that is that it was represented by an administration official in mid-December that $50 million was the level of commitment. And that has, in the time I've been down in Juneau, been echoed by legislators in this body who had been given to understand that was going to be the level of commitment. Now, as I say, that is not something derived from the course of negotiations on this. That is wholly apart from any figures that may or may not have changed hands in the course of negotiations. But there certainly is a disparity between what some people publicly and outside of the context of negotiations were given to understand would be in the package and what in fact eventuated in the speech yesterday.
Do you have a trial set for the rest of the year?
No trial date has been set.
Mr. Chairman, Steve, is it possible, it brought up by the fact that there is a lot of federal money coming in. Is it possible for you to give us the figures, how much that would be? Is it
I think probably the easiest way of getting that is through the current fiscal year budget, which is what we'll list as revenues under education, the amount of federal funds coming in. I don't have the budget in front of me, but I assume it's readily available.
You will have that information.
Was there a description of your program in give us some idea of your background?
I'd be happy to. I'm an attorney at the Harvard Center for Law and Education. That is a program funded by the federal government. It's part of the legal services program nationwide. Now comes under the Legal Services Corporation. We are the national backup center for education matters. And at the request of any legal services program any place in the country, we lend assistance in any case involving education. It was at the request of Alaska Legal Services that we came up and helped out in the conduct of the Bush case.
It's apparent from this discussion that the complexity of this kind of case, and we simply ask for help from the backup center. That's how Steve comes to be here.
What other areas in America is the center performing in this education area in a like capacity?
In several other states, from Boston to the Midwest and Texas. Any place that a legal services program has said we have a complicated case and we need some technical assistance in conducting the case, we are funded as part of the legal services program to come in and help. We were requested by Alaska Legal Services to come and help in this case because it is a very large, complicated case, and they asked for some extra help. That's what our job is.
If there aren't any further questions, I'd like to come back to Stephen Bruce. I think that, there seems to be a general agreement on the committee and some indication expressed by the council president that a legislative political solution to these obvious questions probably is a good course of action for such a business as this committee. I think myself that maybe the best approach for us to take, rather than to go a great deal further into the legal arguments that might arise, would be to look at the social questions and to determine from the Commissioner of Education what the goals and policies of the state board are in this regard right now, and to what extent it's reflected in a proposal by the government. Now, I haven't had an opportunity to examine all the school construction that's proposed and the bond package to the administration. In 1974, though, the legislature appropriated a bond issue in excess of $40 million for rural school construction. That was mostly elementary school construction. But, and I don't know whether that figure that the governor mentioned yesterday reflects a change in priorities or whether it reflects some limitation that they perceive based on the state's financial position. So I think that what we better do, as soon as we have the details, I've had a chance to look at the details of the governor's budget and bond package, this is the further extent we have so far, yesterday, is to bring the commissioner in, and if they're available members of the state board, to see what the goals and policies are, what their reaction is, the principles involved, and their proposals for the solution.
just like to clear up the point. I get from this that there is an obligation that they have to provide education. Is that federal law?
No, that's state law.
Okay, in the case of Randall Institute, which they shut down last year, they shut it down because it was uneconomical and to run and all of this and that. It seems to me, and just by, and I worked real close with that, and there was students and staff and community and all alike that were real concerned, and some of those kids, they weren't influenced, I don't think, to make their decision. But they were happy there, and they were getting a real good education. Some of the finest kids that come out of Alaska came out of Randall Institute. And it seems to me that they could have potentially done something illegal by shutting it down for that same reason. I mean, they're concerned with the cost of all of these things, but they did have the facility there, and those that wanted to go there were able to go there. They shut it down. I just think we've got a case against them too. They haven't made a decision to shut it down just for financial reasons. That was just, and I understand saving is going to happen to Edgecombe, but I don't know anything about that school or how it's accepted. And I spoke with lots of them, and I know some of the supervisors there. A tremendous job they did. There's people over there that worked 16 hours a day for 8 hours pay just to, they were so involved with the program. I think we really made a mistake. We didn't take issue with a point in that particular case. But that facility existed there. It sits there empty right now. The dorms are there. All the classroom facilities are there. They probably got the finest vocational ed shop of any school in southeastern Alaska just sitting there surplus right now. If the federal government is going to make a case of this, why Mr. Sam Hill won't they're spreading money all over the place in the urban area of schools. I, for one, wouldn't mind at all if that money for that some of those extras in education ought to be probably provided or made available to them, but in that particular case. I understand why they're not the kids at home, I do too. But, money is a consideration. If they had a facility there, and those that were there by their own choice, I believe. At least I was led to believe that. And some of the people that live in the North Country that come here to you know, in the legislature and have kids there, I've talked to them, that they'd be well satisfied with what they had, but it was taken away from them.
Interesting to look at the section of the Alaska Constitution that deals with the subject, Article 7, Section 1, public education. The legislature shall, by general law, establish and maintain a system of public schools open to all the children of the state, and may provide for other public education institutions. The interesting thing is that the state constitution places that responsibility on the legislative branch. And so, to some extent, through the Department of Education, the State Board of Education, and local school boards, some of the authority has been delegated. But the responsibility constitutionally remains with the legislature. And it would seem strange to me, not becoming on the legal side of the question, it would seem strange to me with that sort of a mandate and that sort of a history in Alaska that we would have to, that the people would have to seek redress to under the federal constitution to resolve an education, resolve the problems of education.
But in order for us to do that, we're going to have to fill in more information. So when we have a chance to review in a little more detail, just what the program is, and see what the executive branch is proposing and what their goals and policies are. We may find ourselves in a position of redirecting that and changing some of the priorities. Will you gentlemen be in good on how much of the time?
Don Clarkson from Legal Services is here throughout the session for we will be available in short order, and we'll be as accessible as we possibly can be, given the limits of geography, to provide any information that we can, either directly or through the job. But if any...
Okay, a question that might come up naturally is in our discussions and pursue this with the executive branch, a question might come up whether the proposals, policies that they recommend are really the same things that they tell them to keep. That's why I asked that question.
I'm pretty expensive. I live in Anchorage, and I could get down here virtually. I'm pretty sure it's not this.
Well, we'll certainly keep Mr. Fox in the conference.
And we will provide as much information as we can to any member of this committee or others who are interested.
Mr. Greening is the chairman of the Subcommittee on Education. To begin with, it was his responsibility to outline the book. But maybe you're extremely interested in this question. You hear the whole legislature. But thank you very much for taking the time for that. I'm sorry to have to drag out of the 2 days.
No problem at all. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for permitting me to be here.
Other business, the committee, we have to announce it on the floor. We had a bill that we were going to take up this morning, House Bill 121. Apparently, that deals with military credit under the teacher's retirement system. And it was a bill introduced by Mr. Parr in an attempt to make credit provisions equitable. Got a note here that says the administration is introducing soon a bill that covers fractional credit and military credit without the administrative and legal problems that caused the veto in Senate Bill 380 last year. Check that out. If Mr. Parr would like to go ahead with House Bill 121, we'll meet at 11 a.m. We'll announce that on the floor. If he would rather wait, look at the bill from the administration, that meeting will be canceled, and we'll meet at 1:30 this afternoon.
Do you know whether the administration has delivered some sort of a prospectus or handout they're preparing for us on the changes in the government budget? Those are available. We'll review them with staff at 1:30 this afternoon. I'll check and see what happened to them. We've got Kent Dawson sitting in front of some information. They'd like to review with us next week, in keeping with we review the salient features in the governor's budget with budget management. And I'd like the committee to review the little handout that they prepared for us first. So we'll try that at 1:30 this afternoon. Anyone have anything they'd like to bring up? And if not, we'll be adjourned for another.